Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Well, hello there and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scarsbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, I'll be shining the spotlight on pastoral perspectives for the evangelization of culture in Europe. And taking a look at the Lenten sermons of Pope St. Leo the Great. But first I'd like to mark an audience Pope Benedict had on Friday, March the 7th, with the members of the Pontifical Committee of Historical Sciences, founded by Pope Pius XII in 1954, in an effort to promote significant voices of Catholic historical culture at the service of truth and of the Church. Charles Collins reports.
During his meeting with the committee on Friday, Pope Benedict XVI quoted the 19th century Pope Leo XIII, who said the Church has nothing to fear from the publication of documents and opened the archives of the Holy See to researchers. He also said society has changed since that time, and the entire culture is being marked by positivism and materialism. In this environment, the past appears only as a dark background to the present, and where the future aims to build a utopia on earth, even though it's been shown that these utopias are not what they seem. Pope Benedict says this mentality is indifferent to history and marginalizes the historical sciences. Pope Benedict said that such a society is also more vulnerable to ideological manipulation. The Holy Father said the Church, called by God the Creator to defend man and his humanity, has to promote an authentic historical culture and work for real progress in the historical sciences.
Our thanks there to Charles Collins for bringing us this report. Also in the Vatican on Friday, the Pontifical Council for Culture was into the second day of its plenary assembly. Being discussed are issues surrounding the theme of the Church and the challenge of secularization. Among the speakers who've reached Rome for the occasion is one of the British-based advisers to this council. He's Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, who in the afternoon spoke of pastoral perspectives for the evangelization of culture in Europe. I sat down with him for a moment. Pastoral perspectives for the evangelization of culture in Europe. Now, there are a lot of different words there. To start with, culture. How does one define culture?
Well, I suppose on the written version of the talk, the first paragraph, which I'm going to omit in the meeting, is a humorous introduction to the complexity of Europe, whereas bishops in other continents can use one or maximum two languages for their continental meetings. Meetings in Europe are dreadfully complex, and that goes for the Vatican too, and the price of translations is astronomical. I think cultures are used very often as flags of identity, and in Europe we've got that strange tendency to resist uniformity and unity of that kind because it smacks of something imposed from above. So you have to be very respectful of people's different traditions, people's different aspirations and the presuppositions of their lives and all sorts of things, which to them are very precious. Well, to us are very precious.
So culture in Europe... Europe does have a centuries-old Christian heritage, no? Therefore, culture in Europe is imbued with Christianity, isn't it?
That's true, but I think the way Christianity is lived depends on where you happen to have been born. The divisions of Europe after the Reformation are, in one sense, looking at them historically, a scandal. But looking at them in terms of experience, if you, as a young English boy, come to seminary in Rome, as I did, you're very surprised how many buses and trains there are on a Sunday, because we live in a Puritan culture in England. People wouldn't like to hear that, but it is. It's dominated by Puritanism. When I was young, there were no shops open on Sundays. You weren't supposed to whistle on a Sunday. You certainly didn't do washing or anything like that on a Sunday. But in Mediterranean Europe, which is largely Catholic, festive days, like Sundays and holy days, are feasts that you enjoy yourself. And the public services are adapted to that, or at least they used to be. I'm not so sure anymore. But there are big divisions like that. How you view leisure, how you view fun. Carnival here is very different from what it is in the north of Europe and doesn't really exist in England. So there are many different ways culture is linked to Christianity, depending where you live. And then in all the Orthodox countries, it's very different again. From where I live, either in Rome or in Switzerland or in England, they're the places I've lived. And then if you go to Scandinavia, the coldness of Lutheran and Calvinist religion really strikes you very hard, even in Scotland, for example.
And beyond that, you have all the rapidly changing society with which has become increasingly multicultural, no?
Well, whatever that means, multicultural is an easy word to say. If it's a fact that there are many cultures living together, that's okay. But once you speak of multiculturalism, it's no longer a fact, it's a prescription. It's a theory, it's an ideal. And I'm not sure that's an ideal that it can be achieved as easily as some people would have to have us believe. I think the differences have to be more respected and accepted than minimised.
I asked you this at the beginning. You didn't really, in my opinion, reply. What is culture? I mean, culture is cooking, it's reading, it's football, it's a bit of everything, isn't it? It's basically perhaps a way to discuss basic human values, a key to dialogue, no?
I once suggested to my former archbishop that culture is the way we do things around here. And he adopted that expression as if it was his own idea. And I think it is. Culture is the badge of our identity, and I did say that before. It's the way we see the world, the way our traditions have moulded our reaction to the world around us, the way we interact. There are all sorts of conventions and traditions, most of them unwritten, which form our identity, the things which we recognise. Actually, it's very curious, in England, it's far harder to get people to enumerate what makes them English than it is, for example, to get Welsh people to say what makes them Welsh, Scottish people, what makes them Scottish, and so on. England has been so populated by people from so many parts of the globe for so long now that we, in many ways, find it hard to put our finger on exactly what makes us English. But people outside seem to recognise us much better than we do ourselves. And the culture is the way we interact with each other, with the world, and with people from other parts of the world, which does make us a distinctive kind of person or group. The culture is built up out of core beliefs, practices, rituals, traditions, and things like that.
Your talk is from a pastoral perspective, no? You are at present representing Catholic culture at the European capital of culture, no? You're also a parish priest. Obviously, there's two different areas there. What's the difference between just being an ordinary layperson or being Catholic in a parish? Is there a difference?
I think a lot of people get tricked by the word culture into thinking it's high culture. That's a very elitist, classical notion of culture, which is being well-educated, having been taught to appreciate the fine arts and so on. There is a much more, what they technically call, anthropological understanding of culture, which is simply related to what I was talking about before, the ways a society articulates itself, how it organises its life, its core beliefs and so on and so forth. If you know the Liverpool area, where Liverpool is the capital of European culture this year, you would be blind, deaf and culpably ignorant if you didn't see the effect Christianity has had on that area, and particularly, much to the dismay of other Christians, how strong Catholicism has been in the past. It still is, but not in the way a lot of people would like. But Catholicism, the Catholic Church and its various works, mainly missionary work, work for the poor, education, service in hospitals and things like that. There are so many marks of the Catholic Church in our past and also in our present that with the bishops of Liverpool and the small committee, we decided to celebrate the past and to highlight what's going on in the present in order to leave for the future some kind of clearer awareness, both a pride on one level, but much more important than that, a commitment to the continued effective presence of the Catholic Church in our city. For example, mixing many notions of culture, you can see that the work one of our priests does with a group of helpers for asylum seekers has made a tremendous difference to the way they live and survive in our city and the area around the city. Because without his help, without his initiative, which is all based on what he has been as a priest for the last 40 years. Those people would be literally in a mess. They would have nobody else to turn to. And his witness and the work he does with his team is a gem in the presence of the Catholic Church at the moment. At a different level of culture, we also have a fantastic musical tradition in our area, particularly in the cathedral, but not only there. And that contributes to a part of Liverpool life that many know through such different music as that of the Beatles and many of those groups from the 1960s. But even church music has a special tradition on Merseyside, and that's something we want to celebrate with, for example, a thing called 2,000 Voices Praising God, which will take place in the cathedral in November, when we're just going to get 2,008 people. First of all, people from our schools, and then in the evening, the same number, adults or whoever wants to come. And twice we'll have this event on the same day, as I say, once for schools, once for other people. Yeah, just to get people singing, and to be happy singing Christian music in a beautiful church setting. It isn't a performance, it's an experience. And that will be a remarkable day and a remarkable evening.
Getting back to your work as a parish priest, which we haven't really spoken about, how do you touch the hearts and minds of children in your parish with the future generations?
I'm still very new. I think the biggest job in one of the two parishes I have is to make sure the atmosphere in church is that of a church, because it's a very modern building, which is ugly to anyone's standards. But as a liturgical building, it works very well. The other church I have is very traditional, but to contact people and to get any reaction out of them is like talking to, I hope none of them are listening to this, like talking to rows of sardines. Just sitting there all looking the same, and you very rarely get a reaction. In both parishes, however, there's an initiative known as Little Church. The children are taken out of the Sunday morning Mass for their own liturgy of the word, and a very committed group of parents and helpers regularly catechise them in that setting. And in both parishes it's done very well. In one there's about 60 children, and in the other one maybe 40. So every week 100 children in my two parishes are being given special and well-prepared catechesis on the gospel and the theme of the day. That's one way of informing them and giving them a way of being comfortable with the church, with God and so on. But I think there's still a long way to go in terms of helping them to be actually aware in their ordinary lives that God is there, that God is love, and not the policeman. Very often parents manage to convey to their children their own fears and images from their youth, but we've got a long way to go to make people really aware of the presence of God in the whole world, and not just in nature and nice days and parties, but even in suffering and in the ordinary jobs we do, and so that we're aware of God in so many different ways. In my talk here, I think I'm just giving certain aspects of the pedagogical side of evangelizing, ways of forming people and helping them form themselves in an appreciation that God is everywhere and God is in everything and in everyone, and that they should never feel far from God, that there's a lot more to learn about God. It's not just learnt with the head, it's learnt with the heart and learnt in action, reacting and interacting with people, with nature, with all sorts of things. I'm not a pantheist, by the way. I'm very clear on what I believe about God. But I think we've got a lot to do and a long way to go with children. I have, I think, 7 schools in the area of my two parishes. We hardly see any of the children in church at Sundays. So there's work to be done even there. I fear that what they get in the schools is very much secularized, in the sense that it's presented as an option among many options, even though they're in Catholic schools. And it's presented by people who are not themselves practicing anyway. And it's presented apologetically in the wrong sense. People apologising that they're Christians. And, you know, we've got to do religious education, so just put up with it, is the atmosphere in many cases. And I think we've got a long way to go there. And that reflects also on the way we recruit people, the preparation we give to religion teachers, what we expect of head teachers and of people working in Catholic schools. It's a very complex issue. So there are many levels on which one answers the question, what are you going to do for children in your parish?
A big thank you once again to Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, advisor to the Pontifical Council for Culture, currently holding its plenary assembly. Meanwhile, I'd now like to change the subject, picking up on Pope Benedict XVI's weekly catechesis with pilgrims from across the world. Continuing with his catechesis on the Fathers of the Church, on Wednesday he spoke of Saint Leo the Great, a pope whom he described as one of the most influential in history. Becoming Bishop of Rome in 440 during times of severe social unrest, and taking it upon himself to protect Rome from Attila the Hun, whom he convinced to desist from his plans to devastate the city. Leo, the Pope highlighted, promoted the primacy of the Bishop of Rome, remarking how, thanks to his sermons and letters, we can still appreciate his zeal and charity as pastor of the Church, and his theological depth and clarity. In a few moments, I'll be looking at some of those writings Pope Benedict mentioned, his Lenten sermons. I do so with our popular Latin lover, Carmelite, Father Reginald Foster. So do watch the change of pace and tone. Father Foster, you're always talking to me about the sermons of Pope Leo I, Pope Leo the Great, during Lent. What was special about those sermons?
There are 11. Every year he did this. Every year he had one, and so forth and so on about Lent. And
do they correspond to the actual Sundays in Lent? Or
No. Well, no. It would be like the beginning of Lent. You know, that would like the theme of Lent. Of course, you know, the idea of atonement for sin. And
how do you say all these things in Latin? Atonement for sin?
Peccatorum nescio reparatio. That's all right.
And the pillars of our faith.
And so, yeah, certainly.
Like the Pope went strong on almsgiving this year, no? How do you say almsgiving?
Well, the fact is that is very strong in Leo, 1600 years ago, because he said, which is, he's extremely modern, you know, where he says, you know, instead of crucifying yourself, you know, I'm giving up candy, I'm giving up pizzas for Lent. He said, fine, if you want to do that, then you take what you're going to save by these penances, and you give these things to the poor and the needy.
How do you say all that in Latin?
E genus et pauperibus tradenda sunt, quae colligimus ex sacrificius nostris. You can say anything.
You didn't talk about the pizzas and chocolate.
No, not right now, no. But
but you have a word for pizza. And,
well, certainly.
And chocolate.
Well, certainly we have all that stuff.
And drink. How do you say it? Give up pizza, chocolate.
Yes, ergo repudiate teobroma is chocolate. And pizzas are lagana. Hmm. Lagunum. Horace talks about a lagunum. And it was like a cake made with cheese and oil. Comes very close to our pizza.
Hmm. And almsgiving? How do you say almsgiving?
It's eleemosyna. Your Greek word, which is in every language now.
So basically, we talked about fasting, we talked about almsgiving and prayer. How'd you say prayer?
Did he
tell you to pray, Leo the Great?
Oh, yeah, well, there's no problem there.
How'd you say?
To pray for yourself and for others, and this whole spiritual exercise is supposed to be like a spiritual training ground.
He says in his first reflection on Lent, according to what I found on internet, Chapter 5 talks about abstinence, not only from food, but from other evil desires, especially from wrath, which you say is wrath. Is that right?
Wrath, yes. Ira.
Ira, that's easy. Is required.
No, he says that we don't have to. Don't worry about abstaining from meat and stuff, but abstain from bad things, from bad habits. No, he's very, very strong and very, very clear.
He says, let the swellings of pride subside. Let wrath or wrath yield to reason. How do you say that?
That's what he says. A tumor. There's a tumor. A tumor ire. Nescio decrescat et concedat. What did he say for the? I forget the rest of the sentence there. Let it give into. He says it much better, but anyway.
Let the swellings of pride subside. Let wrath or wrath yield to reason. Let the darts of ill treatment be shattered, and the chidings of the tongue be bridled. Let thoughts of revenge fall through, and injuries be given over to oblivion. Let the swellings of pride subside.
Yeah, tumor superbiae residat.
Let
ira.
Wrath.
Ratione cedat.
Yield to reason. Let the darts of ill treatment be shattered.
Iaculum isho, what are you going to say? Injuriarum. Frangantur.
And the chidings of the
reprehensiones of the
tongue be bridled.
Reprehensiones lingue, frenentur. It's really great.
Let forts of revenge fall through and injuries be given over to oblivion.
Yeah, decedant cogitationes ulciones et injurie oblivioni tradantur. That's easy. He says it in a much nicer way, but anyway.
Well, he says, let every plant which the Heavenly Father hath not planted be removed by the roots. That's a nice image.
Yeah, certainly. Radicitus omnis planta, quam Pater Celestis non, we're going to say, seruit, eradicetur.
For then only are the seeds of virtue well nourished in us.
The seeds of virtue are virtutis semina in nobis nutriuntur.
And every
Germen, cum omne extrarium germen,
uprooted from
evelitur de frumenti sagite.
Yeah. That's wheat. Every foreign. Germ uprooted from the field of wheat. But no, for our listeners, we didn't say it in English.
Oh, that's great. No, it's great, really. Ooh.
And he also says further down, if you read, and we can't read it all. I mean, forgive us our debts as we also forgive our debtors, as those who.
Yeah, mm-hmm. We have in the Our Father there one.
But who read these things? I mean, did he speak them?
For sure.
I mean, were they sermons or what?
Well, certainly. Were they called tractatus, tracts? But, I mean, they certainly, I warn the students too, they certainly weren't written to be read, but they were given to be heard. And that's why we insist in school on the music of his sentences. There's a musical
rhythm.
It's out of this world. And it's really to pronounce this out loud. I have the students do that. Pronounce these things out loud. Close your eyes and pronounce them out loud. It's really another experience.
Well, maybe you should start your own radio station.
Now, I have these things on tape, you know. I told you that. Mm. All of his sermons are on tape on the internet.
Who did you do them for?
Oh, for one of the students. I think there are 96 sermons. We filled about 15 tapes, the old system. And then they transferred this onto CDs.
And do you manage to capture the musical sound?
Well, I try to. Certainly the inflection of your voice, there's a progression there. It's really very, very beautiful. It's almost like reading, I would say, decent poetry, Shakespeare, or some classical poet. There's a rhythm there and a beauty.
Leo the Great always spoke about religious matters. These are sermons for Lent, so obviously they're religious. But did he actually have ordinary poetry like about
nature? No.
Nothing is frivolous.
We don't have, maybe he on the side.
Is there a particular sermon that you like, that you'd like to speak to us about?
Oh, I don't know why they're so, I mean, I don't know what. I mean, his sermons on Christmas are the end of the world, really.
Well, we're talking about Easter now.
I understand, but you asked me which ones.
We'll get to those at Christmas.
Well, yeah, I understand. When he gets on the incarnation and God becoming man and one of us and sharing and everything we have and it's just too much.
But the sermon I've been reading from on abstinence was number 5. Number 6 leads to a happy participation in Easter. So basically everything he wrote was to geared towards Easter.
Oh, yeah, he says that for the first sentence. A preparation time for Easter and so forth. The greatest mystery, of course, is the Easter mystery and so forth.
One in this paragraph, he says, let us not pass over the groans of the poor with deaf ear, but with prompt kindness bestow our mercy on the needy, that we may deserve to find mercy in the judgment. How does one say, let us not pass over the groans of the poor with deaf ear?
Yeah, sordis auribus ne praeteriamus, gemitus pauperum.
But with prompt kindness bestow our mercy Sed on the needy.
Alec, alacri, alacri, beninitate. Bestow what?
Our mercy.
Ah, misericordiam tribuamus.
On the needy.
Ah, bene, e gentibus.
That we may deserve to find mercy in thy judgment.
Misericordiam consequi valeamus in judicio. Yeah, those are glorious things, really. I mean, they're immortal. We do this in the office. Like at 11 o'clock, we have like a little coffee break. And now they want me during Lent now. Every day for about 5 minutes, I'm supposed to read from Leo. This is to my colleagues. There are six of us or seven. Mm. And everyone just moans and groans. It's so glorious. You say, look at how he says it. How he says this. And then we're supposed to be so modern and we have all the best ideas. We have nothing, friends. Really, in comparison to these great men.
Why do you think that is? Do you think because it was a different world they belonged to?
Well, for one, of course, there's a natural talent there. Not all popes spoke like Leo did. They just didn't. They just didn't. It's like not everyone wrote music like Mozart.
You're a sort of talent scout. How do you say that with your students? So how would you say talent scout?
Okay. Well, you'd say, virtutum explorator.
Someone talent scouted you years ago. How long ago was that?
It was my teacher.
That was Cardinal Bacci, no?
Well, no. It was actually his successor, Carl Egger. Who died about 3 years ago. So I had him in class. There were three of us in class. And then the Pope's secretary got sick. And Benelli and Paul VI said we
Cardinal
need...
Cardinal Benelli.
Well, he was just an archbishop then. Anyway, as a substitute upstairs. And they said, we need someone to do this work. And one of my teachers said, I think I know the man you're looking for. And that was that. And that was 39 years ago. So I'm going to begin my 40th year in July. Begin my 40th year. But anyway.
Has your Latin improved over the years or
has it got
worse?
Oh, yeah. You get, even like Cicero, the older you get, the more mellow you get. I mean, not youthful, you know, sparklings and, you know, a big show and stuff like that, which I like to do. I wrote about 4 cards I just sent from the Vatican Post Office in Latin. Well, I have my own style. But the older you get, the more mellow you get. And it's interesting to see that Cicero's last orations are real kind of nice guy of a man who's 63, not 23. Mm. There's a difference.
So mellow, Father Foster, how'd you say mellow?
Mellow. Mitesco, mitescere. Mitescere, agreta, mitescere, mituit. Fosterius, mituit. Foster, mellowed. Well, we all do, I hope.
And that's all I have time for on today's broadcast. I'll be back again at this same time tomorrow, so be sure to join me then. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.